This is Health Frontiers, and I'm Lexi Ross. Tonight we'll be discussing the very fascinating and not well-known subject of miasms. Here to educate us is Dr. Russell Schilling. Good evening, Russell.
Good evening.
We are really addressing a topic that not very many people know about, and I feel like we need to just go right ahead and explain exactly what a miasm is and how it occurs in the body.
Well, Lexi, to start, what I'd like to do is just read one paragraph out of a particular book I think that says it all. And the book is titled Dreaming a New World. And it's some information that was channeled through a particular woman here that I know. Her name is Nancy Vandamalen.
Okay.
And this is her first book in a series.
All right.
And this book is essentially just a publication of text of material that was given to her, and there's a section in here on miasms because miasms from this source are regarded as one of the premier health issues of our time. And I'll just start out, this is on page 142 in that particular book, and it goes, a miasm is an independent energy field existing within the human body, which is not a part of the system of that body. The miasm enters the body during a time of great weakness or vulnerability and becomes a satellite functioning within a larger and separate system. The miasm remains dormant and inactive until the appropriate times arise for the expulsion of this energy field. And a person can live sometimes a lifetime in which the propitious or the appropriate time for removal of a miasm may never arise.
Really? Well, what stimulates the miasm to finally activate?
Some sort of a resonance effect in the body.
A what?
In the being. A resonance effect. Some sort of, let's say, stress or condition, something that is in resonance with that original miasm. For instance, in my case, I tracked a tuberculinum miasm back to a previous ancestor several generations before. And for me to bring that tuberculinum miasm up, there would be something that would resonate or trigger in my life, something close to that for some sort of experience.
That was in your own body?
Yes.
This wasn't a body of a patient?
That's correct.
I see. Well, the world of homeopathy really was the first to discuss miasms. How did you get interested in miasms in the first place? I know you're a chiropractor and a former chemical engineer. And how exactly did you evolve to being interested?
When I look backward, Lexi, what I would say actually is that there was an experience of learning how to detect these things through an early study in the area of radionics.
I see.
Which is an arena where you start to look at energy signatures of things rather than physical effects. And these energy signatures for miasms are something that radionics is particularly ideal to. Now, radionics is not something that is prevalent at all out there. In fact, the FDA has some very strong feelings against the area, and I think there are a lot of people who would regard it as experimental or exploratory.
Well, for some of our listeners who don't know what radionics is, can you give us an explanation?
Well, let's go ahead and let's take it in the context of miasms.
Okay.
Let's say that someone has there were originally three miasms that Hahnemann and his contemporaries determined, and that was syphilinum, obviously derived from individuals who had syphilis and the extreme effects on the body, tuberculinum from tuberculosis, and psorinum, which was derived from psoriasis. And these three conditions were all determined through homeopathic diagnosis to be items that people inherited. If your ancestors had them, then you were likely to have some sort of inherited physical weakness or effect from them.
I see.
And in radionics, you're simply finding an instrumentation, a method, to to tune in to some sort of energetic or vibratory pattern that's that particular miasm. And you're looking at whether that's present in a person or not.
Well, does it manifest in the cellular structure itself?
It often ends up manifesting in some sort of physical expression.
But I mean, would you find it, say, in the cell pattern, or how, you know, where, say, if you were looking for a miasm in the body, where would you go to find it?
Well, I'll give you, for instance, in tuberculinum, there are cardiovascular consequences and, if you would, disease patterns that are highly linked to tuberculinum.
Really?
Yes. And the homeopath would do a very thorough intake history and evaluation looking for such patterns. And then he would continue by doing his testing, taking a look and seeing if he can find the actual tuberculinum resonance.
I see. Well, now, miasms can be created emotionally in the body as well, isn't that right?
Yes.
And how would you detect an emotional miasm?
Well, for myself in my practice, what I do is a fair amount of kinesiology.
Okay.
And with that, we take a look at one particular aspect of kinesiology, which is called the neuroemotional technique, and go into that and see if there is some sort of a resonance into the emotional field of the body, and then further focus down and see if I can get a reaction to a particular miasm coding that I go for.
So can you discern, like, say, the difference between, say, an anger miasm or a sorrow miasm or, you know, a psychotic miasm? Can you discern the difference between those various miasms?
There are many different miasmic patterns that one can separate out and sort out. But ultimately, to know what the experience was or the stress was or the forming, what formed the miasm, what kind of intense emotional or physical experience created the stress to create that energy form, would probably need to be done ultimately through psychological means.
I see.
Such as some sort of regression.
I see. When Hahnemann was the doctor of homeopathy, right? And he was kind of the first to discover and talk about miasms. At that time, did he identify emotional miasms as well as physical miasms?
I think that at that time they were greatly focusing on the physical side of things.
Okay.
The emotional side of something is, we've seen a kind of a blossoming in homeopathy looking at those experiences within the last century, within the last 50 years.
Is there anyone in particular that has addressed that issue?
There's one person's efforts that I appreciate a lot, and that it's a gentleman, a British gentleman by the name of Guyton, who's published in that area, and if one takes a look on the internet, you'll find his work.
I see. And what were some of the things that he determined or who was able to determine that was different, say, from Dr. Hahnemann?
Well, I think now what we see is a blossoming and a mushrooming of this realization of emotional stressors and emotional linkage and locking into the system. And when people will go through, say, massage school training, they learn quickly that when you hit certain trigger points in muscles and you do myofascial work, the people will sometimes automatically trigger into experiences which are almost a reliving of these sorts of things.
I see. That's very interesting.
So it brings up the whole idea of the mind and body connection.
For instance, okay, if, say, a client comes into you and they're suffering from some type of emotional miasm, would that be like a thought form that reoccurs for them?
You would expect to see some sort of preoccupation or some unusual focus that person has, whether it be psychosis or neurosis, or maybe an obsessive compulsive pattern, something within this realm. you may very well find that the person has phobias.
I see.
And I think the general thought, the best way to describe it is that the person may have gone through many different biological evaluations for something that they know is a pattern, something that's just not right, something that's wrong.
I see.
And there's just no treatment that gets in and satisfies it. And these people are often shunted off to being psychological cases.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, they're actually miasmic cases.
Very interesting. So, for instance, someone might be put in a mental hospital, and in fact, all they have is a miasm?
I'll give you an example of one patient that I've had that kind of illustrates this.
Okay.
This woman had been marginally functional in life, and she had done a lot of psychological work with a therapist over quite a few years, and it had helped her immensely. But she reached a point where she just was not making any more progress, had hit a wall. And it came to her attention to consider maybe another kind of evaluation, and she came to me. And when I checked her out for miasms, I got a very, very large response on one of the particular basic three miasmic operations. And what we found was that when we gave her the appropriate homeopathic preparation, within a matter of weeks, she had a total turnaround in her psychological work and
really?
Totally got past the barrier.
Wow.
And what was interesting was that when we took a look at the homeopathic preparation and we started to ask about her ancestors, she just naturally gravitated towards focusing on one particular ancestor. And as she did her research more into that ancestor, she found out that he had a very unusual pattern. He had been a very strong figure in Southern history pre-Civil War. And he had some attitudes and philosophies regarding slavery to where he actually had a second family, a black family.
Huh.
And she ended up getting in touch and with the black side of her family, so to speak, and reached out to them and explored and shared her quest. And it ended up being a wonderful, wonderful healing for her to go through and accept and explore and come to a resolution internally about this aspect of her life. And ended up totally changing and becoming much more functional in society.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Was he anti-black or pro-black, and was that black family something he did on purpose, or was that just typical of a lot of Southern slave owners who always felt they could take advantage of their slave labor?
Well, in this case, this person became a very strong, large, significant leader in the KKK.
Oh, my gosh.
Respected.
Wow.
So there was a lot of family history to explore and many things to come to grips with for her.
Wow. Can you give us another example? That's a really excellent one.
I had a patient who, as a woman, a young woman, frankly, was always wanting to urinate. I mean, one of those classic things, and it was never ending. And she would always be running to the bathroom. And her comment was that, well, she would get there, and suddenly, you know, there was no need to urinate. And as we explored the situation, you always go through the physical issues first. And she had had a lot of workups done medically to make sure there were no bladder infections, there were no systemic infections. Everything was normal, yet she had this very unusual, unnatural response. I found a miasm, and we went in to treat it and started to explore it. And as the miasm was dissolving, there always seems to be an expression of what the nature of the miasm was. It just comes up somehow and expresses in the person's life. And
so you mean it comes into their conscious mind from their subconscious?
Yes.
Okay.
And for her, it was an unpeeling of when she was a small child back in Russia, some aspects of child abuse and child molestation.
Wow.
And, you know, it was, of course, quite a thing to go through that and have that unravel and come to awareness. But I think the key is that with these miasms, there is a need to bring the trauma involved to consciousness.
Uh-huh.
And there are many pathways and roads to do that. And that's where the psychological side of treating and dealing with miasms comes in.
Well, do you have to be, I mean, it sounds like you have to do a bit of psychology to know how to bring that into the open.
I would say that quite often it's good to have a psychologist involved in this.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes one can deal with it, one can face it as an individual, but sometimes they can be formidable enough that it's necessary.
Well, you mentioned that there's three major physical miasms. Would you name those again, please?
Syphilinum.
Oh, that's right. The
tuberculinum and psoriasis.
Okay, now
these are the historical ones.
Right. Would you tell us what diseases you mentioned that heart disease comes out of one of them? But would you mention the proclivities towards certain diseases in today's time that would have emanated from those ancestral miasms?
When we look for tuberculinum, we always look for a couple of kinds of emotional profiles, irritability. I don't want to say hyperactivity, but it's a certain kind of overactivity. With syphilinum, we're looking towards neurological effects more.
Interesting.
And with psoriasis, of course, it always draws back to psoriasis, and we usually associate that with some digestive issues.
Oh, really? And
yes.
Like, for instance, what mental aspect the syphilinum create? I mean, what kind of mental problems would that, bring
frankly,
about?
Frankly, what I look for is a certain degree of a lack of rationality.
Oh, really?
Now, one can, that has to, there are many different shades of gray here. From the person who's, the personality is, not exactly Mr. Spock, Dr. Spock, but people who may be a little bit over the edge. They may have a degree of disrespect for rationality, or it's difficult for them to be around rational people. That's one thing that I've seen as a pattern. And I would refer people that are interested, just Google it. There are reams and reams of information that are available online. And it's so voluminous, that it's almost difficult to go into it in this context, Lexi.
Well, I want to encourage anyone who's listening to call in to BBS Radio and let us hear from you. So if people have any questions, I certainly welcome them calling. Russell, what would be the difference? You described earlier in a conversation that we had that a virus is a condensation of consciousness. And how would a virus, a condensation of virus, be similar to a miasm? Or are they similar?
I'm going to answer you by going upstream just a little bit here.
Okay.
It has been known for a fair amount of time that DNA has the ability to store immense amounts of information. And obviously, what do you look to for a mechanism when you know that something is inherited? I think anyone who has had children experiences this, to see the family patterns that get passed on. And when you take a look at a virus is nothing but a piece of DNA or RNA, genetic material. And it has the capacity to store consciousness.
Wow.
I see in my own daughter the inheritance of certain personality and conscious traits from her grandmother. And every parent sees that. This storage, this ability to store this sort of experiential information is a, we have to say, nature has created something here that's absolutely phenomenal. And viruses, in my experience, when someone has a virus, I can pick it up from a miasmic standpoint.
Huh.
There is something going into the body that has an external kind of energetic signature to it. And when I see all of the problems that exist with viruses, I know that we are being assaulted from a different level, from a different direction than we're even really aware of from a straight orthodox medical standpoint.
Really? Would you care to discuss that further? I mean, you're obviously hinting at the fact that there's manufactured viruses right now.
I'll go even one step further. I don't, and I am not violently against vaccination, but I think there are aspects of vaccination that we have not even come to understand. And one is that we are putting RNA and DNA material from viruses derived from sources that we don't know anything about directly into children's and human bodies. And frankly, homeopaths right now are forming an idea of a new miasm called vaccininum from vaccines.
Really?
Yeah.
And wow, that's very interesting.
Probably if you talk to most homeopaths, that's going to be one of their greater concerns. They are very strong to go about the idea of inoculation or building immunity to the little bugs in life using different methods than inoculation.
Let me ask you this. I've heard that sometimes flower essences can be or are used against miasms, and of course homeopathic solutions are used against miasms, and I'm curious as to how effective those two sources are.
Well, flower essences are probably one of my larger tools to figure out what the miasm is, simply because you can form flower essences around the general issues of, let's say, anger or depression or general emotional states. And using these flower essences and homeopathic testing methods, you can start to hone in on what the nature of that miasm is. So these are diagnostic tools as well as treatment tools.
Very interesting.
And there are some other methods that I particularly like in terms of treatment, but they need to be adjunctive to the flower essences because you need to have energy sources that can, in effect, if you would dissolve and break up these energetic patterns that we call miasms.
Well, now, would the flower essences be more effective with, say, emotional miasms than they would be with physical miasms?
You know, oddly enough, no. Think of it this way. If you have a piece of clothing that has a spot on it, and that spot is equivalent to a miasm, an energy pattern that's glommed onto you, stuck to you, how are you going to get it out? You're going to launder it. So you have to come up with something that's a medium that is an energetic carrier that is of fine enough of an essence and high enough of a vibratory nature to just float that miasm right off.
I see.
Okay? So I think it's the idea of laundry, of washing, is appropriate. And flower essences are of a very high vibratory nature. They can be subtle, and I fondly say they're sneaky, because they have few consequences. And you can just sort of give them to the person and be very confident that you're not going to have a lot of side effects or other problems.
Well, that's a blessing.
Yeah. The other thing is that when you get into particularly highly glued on miasms, very strong, highly attached, you have to sometimes be able to up the power a little bit, up the intensity. So there are a few other things that have to be done. And in essence, they're energy sources. And just to kind of put it in perspective, I like to use light.
Really?
I've gone to using laser therapy for this, and it ends up needing to be done using the acupuncture system of the body and having the right kind of light is important. Sometimes it requires ultraviolet, which is, of course, very, very strong compared to regular visible light.
So, in other words, you put the patient in a room with ultraviolet light?
Often what I'll do is I'll be taking the person into a situation where I'll be treating them with possibly some sort of visible light, possibly ultraviolet light. I'll be using flower essences and homeopathics with them. And sometimes, in particularly tough cases, we've used some of the... there was a little thing that was out at one time called a Tesla watch. And the way the Tesla watch generated its little signal was through a particular little kind of Tesla coil. Not high voltage, low voltage, but it puts out enough to work.
Interesting. Would that be like the zapper? Is that similar to the zapper?
The zapper, in some ways comes close. The zapper does not include the coil.
I see.
For a kind of coil.
Because the zapper has been, in my experience, real successful with getting rid of parasites and other little bugs in the system because it emits a low-frequency electrical volt. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's a little low-frequency electrical current that it induces in the body. And that's irritating enough to some of these critters that... they kind of dive for the woodwork. They decide to get rid and get out of the house, so to speak.
That's funny. Well, talking about taking us another step in this area of viruses, what besides the repercussions of the vaccinations, what are you turning up in terms of research into the newer viruses that are happening, and they seem to be resistant to antibiotics, resistant to a lot of different medications?
I'll just throw at you some of the things that I do to treat viruses.
Okay.
I've kind of developed a repertoire of herbals to get rid of viruses. I know that there are people out there that are using things that are very, very close and equivalent to the zapper. There are a lot of people who are using rife-related equipment. Sometimes it's just as easy to get in and use herbals. And think of it this way, we're using something that has a very strong energy signature to it, that is not unlike a flower essence. And I'll, in my own little repertoire, I use a lot of garlic, and I found that one has to use a particular kind of garlic that has a very high allicin content. And unfortunately, allicin is the stuff that makes garlic smell.
Uh-huh.
And it makes us smell after we eat garlic.
Right.
And to get garlic up to the levels at which it's very active and good as a, I don't want to say antiviral, but it does something to enhance the body's ability to deal with viruses, you have to take it at levels that certainly do make you socially unacceptable.
Well, I think it's worth it to get rid of the virus, don't you? I'd rather be smelling like garlic for a few days than laying in bed with a horrible fever and not being able to function.
Out here where I'm at in Colorado, we've had a lot of West Nile.
Really?
And West Nile, I have seen get it right into the central nervous system of people. So you need to deal with it quickly, and you can't play games with it.
What are some of the symptoms with the West Nile virus?
Well, people will get a splitting headache. I had one patient, the wife found him laying on the kitchen floor in a fetal position, and his whole arm and shoulder were numb and then alternating to being on fire.
Wow.
And he had no control or use of that arm. And that West Nile virus had obviously gotten into the nerve roots in that quadrant of the body and just, you know, had really infected and irritated the nerves.
Is that typical of the virus to attack nerve roots?
In this area, I would say that it's what I saw.
Huh.
But, you know, we hear of people that, you know, had the long-term low-level fever, the neurological effects, flu effects, and it just didn't respond to that much in terms of conventional treatment. Of course, antibiotics don't work, so you're depending on building up an immune system that's strong. And what I focused on was doing everything possible up front to prevent the virus from totally invading the nervous system. There have been people here locally who have been wheelchair-bound because of loss of nervous system function with it.
You mean permanently?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. What I have done is to use a combination of herbal extracts, highly concentrated extracts, and they include, let's see, I've used hypericum, I've used lomatium, I've used black walnut extracts, and it seems that for each person, the combination that will work is unique. So that's where the testing for compatibility and for results comes in. I can't offer any one particular little protocol that works. I have used a lot of Chinese mushroom extracts from, let's see, shiitake, reishi, and maitake.
Uh-huh.
They have worked often well to boost the immune system. And there are some other proprietary materials out there that, let's see, there were some sugar compounds. There's one, mannose, is in use quite often now. That has been effective in a couple cases. But it's a challenging thing. And when we hear about the bird flu coming...
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
Let's put it this way. I am looking forward to seeing what it will take with garlic and the hypericum, the lomatium. There's another one, OSHA. All of these. It's going to take some experimentation to find. But I know that there have been combinations that worked in 1918, when the bird flu was last around.
Uh-huh.
And those combinations do include some of the lomatium and the OSHA and the hypericum.
Well, let me ask you this. I've had several doctors that, when I was doing my column, that contacted me about using colloidal silver and the olive leaf capsules.
Yes.
For various viruses. And, you know, I received a body of evidence or research from some traditional doctors and received an article recently from one of the newspapers that I communicate with. And it was poo-pooing colloidal silver and saying that it was ineffective, it doesn't work. And, you know, I've used it myself for 15 years. I found it to be very effective against strange viruses. And I just wondered, if you still feel that it has validity.
I found colloidal silver to work with some patients extremely well and with others that didn't do anything.
Well,
and
that makes
because
sense.
Of that variability, I think that's where it comes in as an issue.
You mean a variability in the quality of the colloidal silver or in just the patient's own metabolism?
I think it's the patient's own unique environment.
Uh-huh.
And I think when you do things in a test tube, they're totally different results, you know, and that's not always valid to something within the human body. And I just feel that colloidal silver is one of those things that you should use or have include in your medicine chest. And when you get a problem, try it.
Yeah.
When you're sitting there and you have 102 or 104 fever, you know, you don't wait around to see for a scientific experiment which is the one thing that's working.
Right. What about the olive leaf? I've always had great success with that.
I consult for a nutritional company here in Colorado as a clinical consultant.
Uh-huh.
And I get to talk to doctors who are using these materials, so I hear a lot of clinical feedback. And one thing I hear about olive leaf is, again, it's something that can have phenomenal effects for one person, yet don't do anything for another. So it's like, Lexi, you know it works for you.
Right.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I would encourage other people, with what we see out in the world right now for viruses, that they may need to play a little bit and find out what works for them.
Well, let me ask you this. Overall, there's a, I think I mentioned to you earlier, there's a gentleman named Calvin Young who's invented a machine called the Vocal, and he's dealing with emotional miasms and with great success. And, is the use of a homeopathic solution always effective against miasms?
So far,
that's
homeopathics, I'd say, have been effective for me.
Okay.
Now, understand, I have suppliers that I use for flower essences and other homeopathics that, you know, have hundreds of different kinds of flower essences. Hundreds.
You mean mixed into one essence or?
No, they're
separately.
They are available separately.
I see.
And you need to test with test kits or some sort of method to find those ones that, you know, you hone down to take.
And the testing that you do is with applied kinesiology?
Yes. That's
okay.
How I do it.
Yeah. All right.
And so far it's been excellent. And I think that you don't need to have that one precise right obscure little flower essence from who knows where on the north slope of
the Himalayas.
In the Himalayas. Okay? You just have to come up with a combination that does the job. And it might be that one little tree bud from that northern slope in the Himalayas might do it. But you might find a combination of three other things that will do it also.
Well, I think it doesn't hurt that you have a chemical engineering background to know how to mix these things.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit of, sometimes it gets a little bit on the witch's brew side.
Well, how long have you been addressing the issue of miasms, Russell?
Well, if I take it back, probably all the way back to the mid-80s.
I see. Well, that was pretty, you know, that you were on the cutting edge then, back then, because I really very seldom heard anyone talk about miasms back then.
Well, at that time, of course, there was classic homeopathy. But when you got into the area of radionics, suddenly people had a much wider awareness. And there have been many, many people who had studied and worked in that area from the 30s on. And over that period of time, some very, very intelligent people, you know, came up with some absolutely wonderful concepts. And what happens in this area is that it kind of challenges you on your concept of reality and how nature really works.
In what way?
Well, are we really just three-dimensional beings? And I think we're coming to an awareness that we're not. We're much more than that. And there's been some work done and some interesting things in the area of free energy and what they call zero-point module machines. There's been some recent patents that have come out. I think in 2002 there was a patent by a gentleman by the name of Tom Bearden. And this really shakes up many people's ideas of what reality is, because it speaks to the fact that there may be other dimensions of existence, other dimensions of consciousness.
And well, isn't that what Power versus Force, the book that was at the top of the New York Times bestseller list,
yes,
he was dealing with subtle energies and how subtle energies affect us and how people are just becoming, you know, coming into the awareness of how those subtle energies really can determine a lot of things in our lives, and we just haven't looked at them before.
Well, that book written by David Hawkins, I think, broke a lot of barriers for many people. And, of course, David Hawkins, as a psychiatrist, was using applied kinesiology.
Right.
Quite simply, and very elegantly and very simply. And the book speaks for itself. Without going into details, I encourage anyone to get that book and read it. But in this area, he even brings up the issue in some of his seminars about energy flow in the body. And miasms create blockages to energy flow in the body.
Right.
And if you go into traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture, they're very concerned about blockages of energy flow in the meridian system. So really, I can make a case that the Chinese have been dealing with miasms, whether they realize it or not, for at least 1,000 years.
Isn't that amazing?
1,000 years.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Do you practice acupuncture as well?
Yes, I do. And it's one of those things that adds a whole other dimension to realizing how these little miasms affect things. And just the whole idea of understanding that these blockages in energy flow can be as remarkable as from a miasm, something that actually originated 3, 4, 6 generations before you in an ancestral line, changes your idea of reality.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's what's so frustrating, I think, about our current allopathic medical field, because they don't consider, well, first of all, they don't consider prevention. And secondly, everything is done on the quick fix basis without understanding what the cause of disease is. And most of the time, the medications that we're receiving block what's happening in the body, and, you know, the body is what gives us signals, and if we're not paying attention to the signals, then we're not going to find out what's wrong. And I think most people today, especially in our society where we have to be part of an economic nightmare where the stress is so intense and we're often in jobs that really affect our personality, our bodies, our physical, everything. People ignore the signals, and they think that if they, you know, just get rid of the signals, they can continue. But, you know, what happens, as you and I both know, is you block those signals, and pretty soon the energy buildup in the body is so intense that you have a serious disease.
Well, that, you're speaking almost right out of the textbooks that exist in Chinese medicine. And it's probably the big issue that in Chinese medicine they are able to find some of the causes or imbalances in the human system far, far before we do in Western medicine. And of course, there have been major advances in Western medicine. But again, the philosophy in Western medicine is that things should be scientifically proven before they go into treatment and use.
Right.
I have heard it said already that more than half of the medical procedures that exist have never been proven.
I believe that.
So what I argue is that the rule of common sense. A couple thousand years of Chinese medicine and experience on billions of people should not be ignored.
Well, I heartily agree. What about Ayurvedic medicine? Is that something you've...
Something even older than Chinese medicine.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yes. And, of course, in their system, they have looking at the nature of human bodies from a standpoint of breaking them down into the kapha type, the pitta type, and the vata type. Excuse me. And
you want to repeat those again? That's pitta, kapha, and vata.
And vata.
Yeah.
Three different types of body expressions, if you would, of general metabolism. And there's a gentleman that was very active professionally in New York City during the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. His name was Emmanuel Revici. And I point his name out because, to me, he was probably the Da Vinci of modern medicine. Unfortunately, he was outside of orthodox medicine, although he had PhDs in what we would now call biochemistry and a medical degree, although it was from Europe before the Second World War. And he came up with his own methods of looking at the metabolic balance of the body and imbalance, and determined some characteristic imbalances that happen with certain types of diseases and health problems. And he developed his own methods of, if you would, treating these imbalances. And it's one of the most effective systems that we have in the Western world.
Well, was he treating them with herbs or what was it?
He came up with his own substances.
I see.
For instance, one, we often correlate some cancers to selenium deficiency or antioxidant deficiency. He came up with a selenium-bound fatty acid that worked for one particular imbalance of his.
I see.
And it was very effective. He was renowned in New York City for his ability to treat AIDS as well as various cancers.
When did he pass away?
He passed away a number of years ago. I think he lived to be like 101 or 103.
So he actually came to this country to operate?
He came to this country after the Second World War and got involved in clinical practice. He did not formally have an MD in this country, although he happened to be a doctor for the French Resistance in the Second World War.
Wow.
And he had developed some unusual refining technology that was in use in the Black Sea, in those oil fields. And when Hitler invaded, of course, his facilities that he had worked on and developed there went to Hitler and were destroyed in the war, and he was active in helping to rebuild those facilities.
I see.
And he had his activities and his interest in medicine. So he was truly a Renaissance man.
You know what, Russell? We're getting really close to running out of time here, and I just want to thank you for an absolutely brilliant discussion, and I hope sometime that we can have you back to maybe talk about Emmanuel Revici. He sounds like a fascinating character, and I'd love to learn more about the methods he utilized because I haven't heard his name before, and I'm sure you could fill us in, and I just want to say thank you, And thank you for joining Health Frontiers, and I look forward to interviewing Calvin Young next week as we talk about his electronic machine that gets rid of miasms. And thank you and good night.
Good night. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.